to the Mindful Birding Podcast, bringing you conversations and insights on the health benefits and joy of mindful birding. Brought to you by the Mindful Birding Network and your co-hosts, Holly Merker and Holly Thomas.
Hello, everyone. This is Holly Merker, and we're so glad you're tuning in. In this episode of the Mindful Birding Podcast, Holly and I answer some of the questions we've received surrounding mindful birding. We enjoyed thinking about the questions, and in this episode, we share some of our personal perspectives through our responses. We actually recorded such a long discussion, we've broken it up into two segments, and in this episode, we'll offer the first half of our Q&A session. Perhaps you too might have some questions, and we invite you to share them with us by sending us an email through the Mindful Birding Network. A link to our address can be found in our show notes. Here in North America, many of us are heralding the return of our local hummingbirds, and while giving nod to that and the joy that they bring, I share an excerpt from a book that highlights their busy lives, but also tells a few stories about the companionship birds can bring us. In the Mindful Birding Nerding segment, Holly Thomas delves into some of the science surrounding how access to nature in various forms help facilitate healing. And now on to our Q&A discussion. We hope you enjoy. So we've been getting some questions about mindful birding, and we thought these would be a great dialogue to share with our listeners. Holly and I are going to take some time to answer some of these.
So one of the first questions that we've received is, what do I need for mindful birding? Do I need binoculars?
That is a great question. And I always say that we are already equipped with all we need for mindful birding. So whatever senses we want to engage in the present moment are what work for us. And so while binoculars can enhance our experiences while we're viewing birds sometimes, it's not necessary. And that's what I love about mindful birding. We can do it anywhere, anytime, any place, and we don't need any special equipment. We just need to be open to slowing down and noticing. What do you think, Hal?
Yeah, I would also add to that. It depends in terms of what you need equipment-wise. I would just say it depends on what style you want to practice. So say you're going to be experiencing a sit spot. You might want a blanket or a tee or a cushion or just something to make you comfy. It's not necessarily required for the experience, but you just might want to think a little bit about what can enhance the experience. And I think that goes for walks too, mindful walks, just bring things so that you'll be comfortable, whether it's the shoes or anything else that might help. And if you like to bring binoculars or a spotting scope or other equipment, that's fine. But it's, like you said, it's not really necessary.
Yeah, I mean, some people even carry cameras with them when they're mindful birding and might practice some mindfulness through the lens even.
Exactly. That raises a whole question about mindful photography. And I know we plan to have more discussions about that, because I think that's a whole episode in itself. We get questions about that a lot.
Yeah, we had that one Mindful Birding Network gathering over Zoom where we did have Susan Preston, who's a photographer who practices mindfulness, share with us some of her techniques and some of her practices. And I know many other photographers who do practice this sort of mindfulness through the lens and just being patient, being aware of their surroundings, and are, you know, mindful in perhaps a different way. I think there's room for that within the practice. And also another way in which to enhance mindful birding through, say, like tools, if we're talking about tools we might bring along with us, would be journals. which is something else we've shared during our Mindful Birding Network gathering about nature journaling and how journaling itself as a practice can help us become perhaps better observers and practice mindfulness in a different way.
Yeah, those are all really good points as well. So I think, yeah, it depends on what type of experience you enjoy or how you want to engage. If you're inside looking out a window, that might look like just a cup of tea, and or maybe you want the sketchbook there too. There are all different ways.
Yeah, that's a really good point. Another question we've gotten is, can you practice mindful birding while looking out a window? Do you need to be outside?
Yeah, I would say the short answer is yes, you can practice from looking out a window. Of course. Yeah, if you're observing and the intention is to be with what is, then yeah, I would call that mindful birding. And I don't think you need to be outside to do it. Frankly, there are lots of days when the weather might be kind of uncomfortable outside. And, you know, or you might just not have the time to go out for a full birding outing, but you've got a great little window spot, or maybe it's your window is, I have a window above my sink. So sometimes while I'm washing dishes or clearing things, I'll be glancing outside and just noticing what's in the garden too. So there are little ways to kind of have incidental or smaller experiences of mindful birding. It doesn't have to be a full-blown outing, I think.
That's a really good point. And there are times when people can't get outdoors. There might be a limiting factor. I know for myself, there was a period of time when I was going through some treatments for cancer. I was bedbound and not able to move. And so all I had was the window. And there are some times in life when that is what we have, is a window for our access to the outdoor world. But even that can be powerful and a really great way to tune in to the natural world and be able to, even if it's just watch clouds go by. So if you're in a setting where you perhaps don't see a lot of birds from a window, maybe it's just noticing and being aware of what the surroundings are. And I find that particularly through a window, it's different. I mean, it's a little different because maybe you're not engaging some of the senses you might if you were practicing mindful birding in an outdoor setting, in that perhaps we can't hear as well. We may not be feeling the same sensations of the sunshine, or perhaps it's a breeze, a gentle breeze on our skin. But I still feel connected to birds, particularly and especially if I'm watching birds that are coming into either my bird feeders or the bird bath that I have out there, or the plants that I'm offering, the native plants that it there's this. It kind of feels like when we talked about this in our previous episode, I just feel that connection and I can find myself in the moment with the birds.
Yeah, I was thinking too, when you mentioned your experience going through chemo, and it reminded me of some of the work that a few folks in the Mindful Birding Network have done with the Cancer Center out near Fort Collins, and setting up binoculars and a big picture window for folks who while they're getting their treatments, as a form of relaxation, as a form of self-care to ease through a challenging time. And I think that's a perfect example of fully engaging with mindful birding, and where the person is not able to be outside at that time, but they're able to engage with the birds or just the scenery in a way that's a perfect example here of what we're talking about.
Oh, absolutely. And with that also comes some benefits, because we know that the practice of mindfulness itself has some effects in helping with pain management. And so I know that there have been some studies looking at people who are undergoing treatment for cancer, who are receiving chemotherapy and having access to a view through a window and looking at what's going on in a garden that's right outside the Cancer Center window, and noticing that mindfulness itself, the practice, actually, when we're talking about mindfulness-based stress reduction as a practice, was developed by Dr. Jon Kabat-Zinn, who used it initially in the context of working with people who are dealing with chronic pain and or were going through cancer treatments, and noticing the benefits that it has. And when we pair that with watching birds, it's almost, I mean, it just becomes this kind of perfect marriage, this perfect union, which can amplify the benefits of both of these practices of observing birds. And it's such a positive distraction. And so I'm so glad that you brought that up and about the great work that some of our friends in Colorado are doing. And we hope to have them come on the podcast at some point to share that very important and inspiring work that they're doing out there.
Yeah, that'll be great to devote a podcast to that as well. So one of the other questions that we get that kind of ties in a little bit with what we were just talking about with looking out a window is, where should I practice mindful birding?
Yeah. Well, that could be anywhere, in my opinion, right?
I think so. Yeah, I think anytime, anywhere, you know, if you're inclined to think birds might be around, or you're outside, or you have access to a window, then yeah.
Yeah, sometimes I find myself even walking across a parking lot and noticing a bird and just kind of putting myself, allowing myself to escape into the present moment, if you want to call it an escape. And I will say I call it an escape, because for me, it's escaping from worries about the past and what's going to happen in the future, and instead being fully present in the moment with the bird. And so for me, that feels like it can be really a short period of time. Even if it's just like a minute's worth, I'm still practicing mindfulness. I don't think that we need to like either be in a certain place to do this, like we're saying. And I don't think we even need to put like any sort of time frame on it. Like, it can be a very short period of time. Or, you know, if I'm guiding mindful birding experiences, sometimes we do this for about 2.5 or 3 hours.
Right. And that's another question that we've gotten was, how long does it need to be? And I think you're pointing to, it can be as long as you like or as short as you like. What time do you have, or what other things are pulling on your attention that really you might need to attend to, versus what are the opportunities available? I think that brings up the really interesting kind of broader question about that comes up with practicing mindfulness itself. And, you know, there are formal practices where people sit down to meditate or sit down or get on their mat to practice yoga or have their Calm app where they're going to play a guided meditation, or there are all these different ways of doing it, right? But there's sort of preparation for the rest of life in a way. And they could be 1 minute long. It could be as short as one mindful breath, or it could be, you know, a 6-day silent retreat that somebody engages in, and they're all okay. And the same thing with birding opportunities. I think, what time do you have? Are you walking across a parking lot? Could you take just a breath and really notice what's going on around you? You're standing in your house looking out a window. Can that be a mindful moment? Or you're planning a trip with friends, or you're going to a sit spot, or the list goes on and on. As many ways as you can imagine, you can think of bringing mindfulness to that, and also as an opportunity to really bring your attention to the present moment, and also cultivate that attitude of open acceptance, which I think is really sometimes where the kind of rubber hits the road. If you want to say, like, when we talked about loneliness, that study that came up in the loneliness episode was really that the benefits weren't so much about bringing attention to the present moment, but as about cultivating the open acceptance to what shows up. And so those two aspects of mindfulness, the attention and the cultivation of a non-judgmental kind attitude, are really the keys. So can you bring that to your birding experience, whatever it is?
Absolutely. Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. And this sort of goes into another question that we've received, which is, what if I can't meditate or don't know how? Can I still practice mindful birding?
And what do you think about that? What's your immediate reaction to that?
My immediate reaction is, this is the perfect gateway into mindfulness. And mindfulness and mindful birding aren't the same to me as meditation. I have a hard time meditating. I always have. I really want to do it because I know that it's this sense of calm and peace, but it can be really difficult for me to break away. However, birds just kind of are the perfect guides into mindfulness because I can find myself in the present moment with the bird. And I'm not worried about what happened, as I was saying, what's going on, what my to-do list is all about. I'm not ruminating or having those negative thinking loops while I'm watching a bird. Instead, my entire focus is on the bird. And it allows me kind of just this kind of compass direction that is really powerful in this way. So whereas I don't feel like I'm good at meditating, I do feel like I am good at practicing mindfulness. And a lot of it has to do with the birds themselves. And so, yeah, to me, it's like, this is the perfect way to practice a form of meditation or mindfulness is through birds and mindful birding.
Yeah, I would also say, I don't think meditation is really the same as mindful birding. And I think even by meditation, people mean so many different things. There's oftentimes an image of, you know, this sort of Zen meditator sitting quietly, just with this image of clearing the mind. There are also a million different guided meditations. There are ways of focusing the attention with mantras or meditative movements that people use to focus their attention. But I think you make a really good point about birds being a way to draw our attention that is easier, I guess, or like there's less resistance to that because birds, so many people find birds delightful and interesting and captivating. So there's not that tendency for the mind to wander. But I think it's really interesting. Like, we often hear that people say they don't think they're good birders. And you use the phrase, you didn't think you were a good meditator. And there's that layer of judging oneself with the whole process, right? Which is another area to offer self-compassion or even raise the question of what does that mean to be good at something? Mm-hmm. Yeah, because I would just say, if the process of meditation or mindfulness is to turn one's attention to the present moment with kindness and without judgment, then that's all it takes to be good at it, is just to do the practice. There's not really an end result involved there of achieving some blissful state. It's more about the practice itself and opening to what comes up.
Yeah.
And the same thing with the birds. Right? When we practice mindful birding, it's bringing that same kind of generous, open-hearted attitude of what shows up and noticing. And even if the experience isn't always pleasant or delightful, but just to broaden our ability to be with what is, that open acceptance part.
Yeah, absolutely. And you're right. It's easy. We feel like, you know, like you're saying, I am judging my own experience. I'm judging my own aptitude and capacity for meditation, or, you know, we do this all the time. And with birding, I feel like it's easy for me to get wrapped up in something like, I didn't get a good enough look at a bird, or I don't know if I can identify the bird. I become judgmental of the experience instead of letting it be what it'll be and not framing it upon like these sort of constraints of how it should be, right? And I think that's one of the benefits of mindful birding is we don't have to worry about labeling. That's not, you know, labeling a bird with a name is not really the primary intention of mindful birding. I mean, sure, some of us, like, it's easy to have a name pop in because we can't help it. It's like seeing your best friend and you know their name, or, you know, you're going to recognize them that way. But it's a different sort of intention. And when we allow ourselves to just be okay with what is, and sometimes what is not, then I think that that is when it really kind of has those extra benefits. And yeah, that's what I love about it, is that it just kind of brings us naturally into the present moment, and we don't really have to think about it too much. It's sort of natural and easy.
And even those opportunities where the judging mind makes an appearance, like a little bit of frustration about not getting a good enough look, or somebody else saw it and you didn't, or something blocked your view, or you showed up 5 minutes after the bird was there, whatever those little frustrating things could be, are also opportunities to just recognize, oh, this is my judging mind. This is coming up. And it, you don't have to go into a deep analysis of it, but just to recognize your own mental patterns, your emotional reactions to things, those are all opportunities to become more self-aware. Yeah. And so that when these patterns kind of come up, it can give us that opportunity to pause instead of just reacting. We can have a moment to have emotions and thoughts guide us wisely rather than just lead us into knee-jerk reactions to things. So I think there's opportunity for self-growth there too.
Yeah. This is Holly Merker, and I'm going to read an excerpt to you from the book called The Life of Hummingbirds by Alexander F. Scutch, illustrated by Arthur B. Singer. The book was first published in 1973. This is on page 87. Scutch writes that birds form personal attachments can hardly be doubted by the naturalist in the tropics, who sees many kinds of flying two by two throughout the year, even when the nesting season is months away and their reproductive urges are dormant. But hummingbirds are different. Their social impulses are minimal, and except in a few species, their association with a partner of the opposite sex lasts only long enough to ensure the eggs will be fertilized. How unexpected, then, to discover that at least some hummingbirds are capable of responding to the friendship of the man or woman who provides sweet nourishment for them. During the year that the artist Arthur Fitzpatrick lay sick in a California sanatorium, he had a feeder hung outside his bedroom window, where he could watch the feathered visitors. After the usual skirmishing, a male rufous hummingbird won firm possession of it as his feeding territory and spent much of his time there sipping syrup and chasing away intruders. The presence of a creature so brilliant and full of vitality, so indomitable in the defense of his feeder, cheered the invalid, gave him an outside interest, and hastened his recovery. When at last Fitzpatrick was permitted to go outside in a wheelchair, the rufous left the feeder to zoom around his benefactor's head, then poise in front of each lens of his eyeglasses as though in friendly greeting. Even when the glasses were removed, the hummingbird hovered before the man's eyes. It was not his own reflection in the spectacles that attracted him. When the convalescent finally returned home in a car, the rufous somehow followed to his house, 8 miles away. Then, to build up his strength, the artist began daily walks on which the hummingbird always accompanied his human friend, flying ahead and perched until the slower pedestrian caught up. Observant and curious, the rufous, by hovering before whatever interested him, called his companion's attention to much that, alone, he might have overlooked. Once a family of quail chicks with their strutting parents, once 7 baby skunks, once a large rattlesnake lying half hidden in the path. After his full recovery, Fitzpatrick returned to his work in the city, and a month passed before he could revisit the mountains. Yet, seconds after he alighted from his car, the Rufus was there, whizzing around his head and dancing back and forth before his glasses. This, which reads like a fairy tale, yet rings true, is about the best hummingbird story I know. I can believe it more readily because the Rufus hummingbird's attachment to the man who fed him seems a further development of that personal recognition of the provider of syrup that Althea Sherman had noticed in her ruby-throated hummingbirds long before. And I myself have a bicolored ant bird who would fly up whenever he saw me in the forest and follow me closely for long distances, catching the insects that I stirred up from the undergrowth and ground litter. The remarkable part of this story is that the Rufus was apparently not fed on his walks with the artist, although he doubtless visited flowers and caught insects along the way. He seemed to accompany the man because he liked his company. What makes this kind of an interesting excerpt from this book is just that Dr. Alexander Scutch, being a well-noted field ornithologist who spent much of his life and career in the tropics, wrote over 40 different books on birds and natural history, and many of them were research-based and had a lot of context in regard to the scientific aspect of birds. But this one clearly touches on the emotional and that of the relationships that we can cultivate with the birds surrounding us.
Now bringing you some mindful birding nerding, the science segment where we'll explore the growing body of scientific evidence on the health benefits of birding, time spent in nature, mindfulness, and other related topics. In our discussion earlier, Holly Merker and I touched on the question of whether one could practice mindful birding by looking out of a window. And today I want to share with you some more insights on that. In 1984, Roger Ulrich published what has become an oft-cited paper in the prestigious journal Science, titled, View Through a Window May Influence Recovery from Surgery. The study examined the medical records of patients who had been in for gallbladder surgery and compared their recoveries to whether they were assigned to a room with a window view of a natural setting or to a view of a brick building wall. As it turned out, those with a view of a natural setting recovered more quickly, had better evaluations from hospital staff, and took fewer painkillers while recovering. So Ulrich was among the first to begin to notice that exposure to a natural view might be related to well-being. But what gave Ulrich the idea to look at how a window view might alter patient outcomes? Going back in time a little, to 1981, Ulrich and other colleagues had begun to develop a theory that has since become known as the psychoevolutionary or stress reduction theory. This is the idea that humans prefer environments associated with safety and resource availability, things like access to water, shelter, and vegetation. The theory is that as our species evolved, the environments that have allowed for our survival have come to be viewed as stress-reducing and contribute to our well-being in this way. They reported these 1981 findings in a paper titled Natural versus Urban Scenes, Some Psychophysiological Effects. In a nutshell, subjects looked at one of three sets of slides. One, slides with nature, including water. Two, nature with vegetation, but not water. Or three, urban views with neither water nor vegetation. The scientists measured things like brain waves, heart rate, and emotional states, and they found that both the nature views were correlated with more positive brainwave patterns and emotional states, but not the urban views. So this theory reinforces the idea that landscapes which have supported our evolution and provide resources and safety contribute to our well-being, and it kind of makes sense. So back to that question, can you practice mindful birding at a window? By all means, practice mindful birding at a window. It's good for you. Until next time, I'm Holly Thomas, signing off from Mindful Birding, Nerding. For this episode's Joy of Birdsong, we Hollies thought we'd share with you some of the birds from our recent travels.
It's true that some of the less charismatically patterned birds to the human eyes have some of the most melodious songs. Wrens, thrushes, and sparrows come to mind when I think of some of the most ear-pleasing songs and those which many people would say touch their hearts and spirits. I've been doing some traveling around the U.S. in recent months and encountered some of these beautiful avian musicians. First, I'll share a snippet from the sounds of the lush, fern-filled forests in Blaine, Washington, where the small brown Pacific wrens scurry around carpets of thick green moss and fallen limbs of the nearby firs and spruces. Together with my friend Marcia, we encountered several Pacific wrens who boast one of the most complex songs, scaling upwards as if climbing a staircase of diamonds, sparkling with each step. On a recent trip to South Texas, I was happy to be reunited with Cassin's sparrow, a bird of the southern Great Plains and Desert Southwest. This long-billed and plain-looking sparrow announces its presence through a most melodious song, a musical pattern that hit songs are inspired by. And when I listen, the stress and anxiety I'm holding just floats away.
It seems like so many people were swept up with eclipse fever this year. Myself, no exception. I had never seen a total solar eclipse, and I traveled to Texas, outside of Austin, to connect with some friends for the spectacle. On my drive out, I passed right through Texas Hill Country, and if you've ever had the good fortune to travel through this part of Texas in early April, you know how lovely it can be. The famous blue bonnets and a dazzling array of other wildflowers paint the landscape with blues, reds, oranges, and yellows against a background of verdant, lush green. On my way to the eclipse house, I couldn't resist stopping at one of my favorite places to go birding on this route, South Llano River State Park. Purple martins greeted me at the parking area on the way to the bird blind, where I paused and then traveled down the trail, where I was treated to the marvelous twittering of this male black-capped vireo. A few days later, after the eclipse, I had a chance to visit Pedernales Falls State Park, about an hour west of Austin. This state park is home to one of the other iconic Texas Hill Country birds, the golden-cheeked warbler. As I walked through the park, I heard several golden-cheeked warblers singing and recorded this bird to share with you. Picture him sitting in a freshly leafed-out tree, blue sky behind him, me down below, looking and listening with joy.
tune in to our next episode, where we talk with author and therapist Pamela Lowell about her newest book, My Summer with Ospreys, A Therapist's Journey Towards Hope, Community, and Healing Our Planet. Don't forget to check out our website, themindfulbirdingnetwork.com. Become a member, it's free, and join our growing flock of people interested in mindful birding. Stay up to date on our next gathering, our blog, and mindful birding events from around the world. And you can follow us on Instagram too, at Mindful Birding Network. We look forward to sharing time with you in future podcasts. And until then, we wish you happy mindful birding.